Good morning, everyone. Good morning. The Board of Supervisors is now in session. If everyone would please rise and join me in the flag salute.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Any changes to the agenda, please?
You have several changes to today's agenda. Under consent agenda, item B7 is submittal of a bid opening report for construction of State Highway 101 in Templeton at the Los Tablas Undercrossing, contract number P12A182, First District. Recommendation is for approval and instruct the chairperson to sign contract documents with A.J. Diana Construction Company, Inc. in the amount of $1,067,370. Staff is requesting that the title and the cover sheet be amended to include a budget adjustment amount in the amount of $75,695. Item B8 is submittal of a bid report for Phase 2 overlay of Orchid Road from Avocado Lane near Edna, California, contract number P12A299, 4th District. Recommendation is for approval and instruct the chairperson to sign contract documents with A.J. Diani in the amount of $113,162. Staff is requesting that the title on the cover sheet be amended to include a budget adjustment in the amount of $242,000. Under amended board business items, item F1 is consideration of a request to improve, one, in concept, the acquisition and implementation of the criminal justice information system at an estimated cost of $2,200,000, and two, a budget adjustment in the amount of $268,386 from Fund Center 136, Sheriff Corner, for the first phase of the implementation. The staff report in the transmittal lists two budget adjustment amounts, $268,386 and $269,000. The correct amount is $268,386. Under added items for closed session, under pending litigation, you have the following added items. Number 10 is Gardner versus County of San Luis Obispo. Number 11 is Gulf Underwriters Insurance Company versus County of San Luis Obispo. Number 12 is Duke Energy Morro Bay LLC versus San Luis Obispo County Assessor. Number 13 is Napomo CSD versus County of San Luis Obispo. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to 72-hour noticing requirements. You have one additional amended item on the consent agenda, item B4, request to approve letters supporting the Central Coast Resource Conservation Development Council, the CCR, C&D. Recommend approval and instruct the chairperson to sign. Due to a technical correction, the first page of the letter of support needs to be replaced. The amended pages are attached for your approval. And that's all your changes to today.
Thank you very much. With that, we will go to the presentation calendar.
Move presentation calendar.
Second.
May we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. Mr. Linthal, would you care to read your...
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, it's a real honor for me to present this to Sergeant Bruce Wiedmer of the CHP. It's probably the most fun I've had in the first 3 months of my job. This is the first resolution that I've had to the pleasure of presenting, and I just want you to know that in my years in law enforcement, I never met a finer person that ever wore a uniform. He's one of the best. When you look up CHP Sergeant in the dictionary, you'll see words like leadership, character, duty, commitment, and you'll see a picture of Bruce. That's the truth. Now to the whereas. Whereas Bruce Wiedmer joined the Highway Patrol by entering the CHP Academy in June of 1970 after serving 4 years in the United States Army. Upon graduation from the CHP Academy, he reported to the Central Los Angeles Area Office on September 5th, 1970. Whereas he was promoted to Sergeant on January 30th, 1981, serving South Los Angeles and Central Los Angeles, and finally transferred to San Luis Obispo in February of 1981. For the majority of his career in Los Angeles, he was assigned as a motor officer and sergeant. For those in the room and in our audience that are old enough to remember this, next time you watch Nick at Night and you see the opening segments of the program Chips, that's Bruce riding the motorcycle for all the stunts that are there. You didn't know he was a celebrity. Whereas, Sergeant Wiedmer also served on the CHP Protective Services Detail, providing dignitary protection for Presidents Carter, Reagan, Bush, and Clinton, as well as many other dignitaries. He also served as a member of the CHP shooting team, investigating numerous officer-involved shootings, several of which he was involved with himself, so he has been there on both sides. Now, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby recognize Sergeant Bruce Wiedmer for his 34 years, 6 months of service to the California Highway Patrol, 24 of those years in Slo County. Be it further resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby wish Sergeant Wiedmer a long and happy retirement. Bruce, can you come forward?
While we have the camera and we have so many officers in uniform, why don't we invite everybody to come here? It would be a good picture for us to carry it with our driver's license.
Come on down.
Come on down, guys. Ladies. You're getting the center. Mr. Goggins, we need you too, sir.
That's Chief Goggins.
Yes. Chief Goggins, he came?
To them.
Put him on the right or left?
You might have to squish. Okay. You guys are going to have to squish together.
Yeah. No, he's all the way in the back.
I feel like one big family.
He's got it.
Do you have it?
I got it. Hang on.
I'd like to have one for each one of my cars.
Yeah. I was going to say one for your kids, too. You got it?
Yeah. Vicki, get one of
Thank you very much. I really appreciate this. It's an honor for me to be here and get this.
You can move the microphone closer.
I should be the one writing a resolution for, if I knew how, for everybody, all the support and the friends like Jerry and the people I worked with and all the support that I've had throughout my career, and especially here in San Luis Obispo. My career wasn't a job. It was a privilege for for me to do what I did, and for the support that I've had from my compatriots like Jerry here, and a terrific guy. We worked with him, and we did a lot of projects together, the riot stuff and everything. Jerry was great with that. And all the guys that I worked with, the men and women that I worked with in this job, been a privilege. Thanks a lot.
With that, we will move on to the next resolution.
Roger. Thank you, Madam Chair. It gives me great pleasure as a Rotarian to read this resolution recognizing Rotary's 100th anniversary and their contribution towards humanity locally and globally. What I'm going to ask at this time, if all the presidents will please come to your right-hand side of the podium, and I'm going to read the resolution, and as I get done with the resolution, I would like you each come towards Supervisor Ovid, who will then give you your resolution. I will say mine to the Queen of Rotary, Miss Anita Schauer. You can accept mine. Also with us is Dick Cameron, who is the president of Cambria, and he's celebrating his birthday. Dick, as you go back, you're going to pay $1 per wear resist to your Rotary Club.
$1 a year.
$1 per year.
Okay. Whereas the world's first service club, the Rotary Club of Chicago, Illinois, USA, was formed on February 23rd, 1905, by Paul Harris. and whereas Rotary's popularity spread throughout the United States in the decade that followed. Clubs were chartered from San Francisco to New York. By 1921, Rotary clubs had been formed on six continents, and organizations adopted the name Rotary International a year later. And whereas, as Rotary grew, its mission expanded beyond serving the professional and social interests of club members. The organization's ideal is best expressed in its principal motto, service above self. Rotary's code of ethics has been translated into hundreds of languages and planted on the moon's surface and consists of the four-way test. Is it the truth? Is it fair to all concerned? Will it build goodwill and better friendship? Will it be beneficial to all concerned? And whereas Rotarians became increasingly involved in promoting international understanding in 1945, and 49 Rotary members served in 29 delegations to the United Nations Charter Conference. And whereas an endowment fund set up by Rotarians in 1917 for doing good in the world became a not-for-profit corporation known as the Rotary Foundation in 1928. And in 1947, Rotarians launched the first program called Ambassadorial Scholarship, and today contributions to the Rotary Foundation total more than U.S. $80 million annually, supporting a wide range of humanitarian grants and education programs. And whereas, in 1985, Rotary made a historic commitment to immunize all of the world's children against polio, and as of 2004, Rotarians have immunized more than 2 billion children worldwide at a cost of $500 million. And whereas, at the dawn of 21st century, Rotary expanded its service efforts to address such pressing issues as environmental degradation, literacy, world hunger, and children at risk. And whereas, in 1989, the Rotary organization admitted women for the first time worldwide and claims more than 145,000 women in its ranks today. And whereas today, 1.2 million Rotarians, including Supervisor Ovid and myself, belong to some 31,000 Rotary clubs in 166 countries. Thanks to their efforts, children are strong and healthy, and young adults have received an education they would not have had the means to pursue on their own. And now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered that the Board of Supervisors of the County of San Luis Obispo, State of California, does hereby recognize Rotarians for their contribution locally and globally during their first century of service. Congratulations.
I am Susan Needleman Brown, and I am very happy to be the president of the Rotary Club of Templeton. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Scott Nichols, president of the Grover Beach Club, and we are proud to be serving our community. Thank you.
I'm Dick Cameron. I'm president of the Cambria Rotary Club, and very happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm Janet Jeffrey, and I'm the president of the Los Osos Rotary Club. Thank you.
I'm Ralph Hoskins, and I'm the president of the Rotary Club of San Luis Obispo de Tolosa, and I'm very proud to be here.
Thank you. I'm Tom Tullidge. I'm president of the San Luis Obispo Daybreak Club. And watch for the new bandstand pavilion coming at Mitchell Park.
I'm Glenn Baldwin, president of the Rotary Club of Cambria, Sunrise Centennial. Our charter night was February 23rd. We are a brand new club. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Tom Gieselin from the award-winning Rotary Club of Napomo, and I'd like to thank the Board of Supervisors for the recognition that they bestowed on all of us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And John Hammond, president of the Paso Robles Rotary Club, giving 82 years of service to the North County.
Good morning. I'm Jim Hoffman, president of the Rotary Club of San Luis Obispo. We've been in San Luis Obispo for over 84 years and proud to be a part of an organization that's providing world peace and service throughout the world and community. Thank you again for 100 years.
Good morning. I'm Gregor Jones. I'm past president of the Itasca Rotary Club. We're celebrating our 55th year this year, and I want to thank you very much for this honor.
Good morning. My name is Anita Schauer, and I'm president of the Rotary Club of Pismo Beach, Five Cities, Cacho's Club. And on behalf of our club, Cacho, I want to thank you very much for this wonderful honor.
Thank you. Before all of you go away, we'll be glad to have a picture with all of you taken with the Board of Supervisors as soon as...
Cacho, I was going to say, while you're coming up, a little bit of Rotary history, and I'm going to get this wrong, but Santa Maria Valley chartered San Luis Obispo Monday. Is it San Luis de la Tosa is Monday?
No.
San Luis Monday. And San Luis Monday Club chartered Paso Robles, and then I've lose it from there. And that represents over, I think, somewhere close to 90 years in San Luis County.
And the San Luis Monday Club had a lot to do with San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. Okay, who has a camera that will give it to Vicky and she'll take a picture?
Want to give your camera to Vicky and the battery died.
Okay. Well, let's get one from CHP.
If you ask them to bring their camera in, the CHP in the back.
Okay. While we're waiting for the camera, do we have any Rotarians sitting in the audience? Would you all stand, please, so we congratulate you as well. And be sure everybody were wearing their Rotary pins, otherwise there'll be $25 charge. That's fine.
Are you ready?
50. Okay, are we all smiling?
Our government camera broke.
We'll see this in the post office. Wait. Okay. Right, don't move. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Okay, and thank you all very much for coming. With that, we will move on to our consent agenda. No, excuse me, public comment first. I have three request to speak forms for public comment. The first is Jesse Arnold.
Thank you, Chairman Bianchi and members of the board. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. I'm here today to speak about BT corn. BT corn is a genetically engineered corn. The BT stands for Bacillus thuringiensis, or it's a type of bacteria. So you could also think of BT as standing for bacterial toxin. At any rate, what they've done is taken the gene from the bacteria that produces the toxin and engineered it into the corn. So I think this ought to be labeled and it should be tested further. Anyway, I'd like to read a paragraph from a letter I wrote to the Tribune last fall. To the proponents of genetically engineered BT corn, I challenge you to show me a single non-industry sponsored long-term study showing that BT corn is safe for human consumption or safe for the environment. Now, BT by itself has been around for a long time, and it's known to be of low toxicity to people. But taking the gene out of the bacteria and engineering it into the corn gives you a whole new entity. And since it is new, it needs further testing. And also in the process of engineering the BT gene in, they use one or two other genes, which, again, it's a totally new concept. Now, you may think that the USDA or the FDA or the EPA have done tests on this product, but that's not the case. The usual procedure is for the biotech industry to run their own tests, and then they submit the results to the relevant government agencies, and the agency just looks at the report and says, oh, yeah, that's fine. Go ahead. So, as I say, my challenge to these people, this letter I wrote was dated November 29th of 2004.
I haven't had a word, not a phone call, not a letter, not a peep out of anyone providing me any evidence of a long-term study about the safety of this corn. So, once again, we should not be the guinea pigs. This product should be labeled, and I believe it should have further testing. Thank you.
Thank you. Public comment request to speak forms are coming in, so I'm going to call two names, and the first name will go to one microphone, the second name will go to the second one, and then I will keep repeating that so that you can come forward when your name is called, if you would, please. Ann Ketchenside, I believe it is, followed by Eric Greeney.
Yes, good morning. I'm sorry I'm not quite prepared because I tried to go on radio today with one of the issues, and I will be hitting the newspapers. We have kept silent too long. I am here today to represent the vetters. I'm not their attorney. I'm a friend. The first issue I want to bring to the board's attention, which some of these issues I'm trying to bring to your attention because they could be lawsuits against San Luis County for not helping this family, and on the other side of the coin, for upsetting and hurting and possibly causing a heart attack to Mr. Vetter. We've already had one gentleman, Don Hurd, who passed away in the city of Atascadero due to persecution on his family. His wife is not going to sue at this time because they have backed off of her. My first issue is that Mr. Vetter and his family had a man named Benny Richardson coming and acting as their paralegal when he is not licensed. He took Mr. Vetter's father's death certificate, took it to the bank, took $500,000 in stocks, and put in his name. This was a little over a year ago. Your district attorney and the police department have over 200 to 300 pages on this over a year ago and have not acted on it. I'm here today to petition the board to please talk to the district attorney and the police department to do something about this gentleman that is running around buying new suits each week on the dividends of the vetters' money. That's all I'm going to say on that issue. I'm going on to the land issue now. The vetters have owned their house in the San Luis area since 1932. These are people that should be grandfathered clause in. I haven't had the time to study on the grandfather clause. These are people who have put money into the community since the 1930s. These are people who are going to inherit, when the grandmother dies, I believe over $200 million worth of property. Right now, their house on Rosario is under attack again. They sued the city of Atascadero and won and had this paralegal steal most of all that money. Their attack in San Luis Obispo is under attack. Mr. Vetter has a bad heart. I am here asking you to ask your San Luis Police Department, who's coming there on a weekly basis, scaring these elderly people, to stop. But to use the department to go after the man that has their $500,000 so that they can clean their properties up, because they are complying to clean their properties. But it's hard to go outside to clean your property when you're scared of the abuse of a police department. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. We have no jurisdiction, by the way, over the city of San Luis Obispo.
You don't?
No, we have none.
Well, you know, I've run for different offices, and I know you can talk in hand in hand. I just need to, one thing, though, you do have a county office that is holding $60,000. I was in the meeting. They are holding $60,000 of the Via property money. I helped do the cleanup. They said we were going, they said clean it up.
But your time is up. So
okay. Well, I'd like you to check into these things.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Eric Greening, followed by Linda Hall.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and I'd like to follow up on Mr. Arnold's comments and also on the comments from last week. As you remember, we were when I left off last week, I was just beginning to discuss seed saving. We are in an area with limited water resources, and most of the standard agribusiness corns are notoriously thirsty, and they are notoriously high maintenance in terms of pulling nutrients out of the soil. And there are, in areas east of here, in the desert areas, actually locally adapted varieties of corn that have been grown by indigenous people for hundreds and thousands of years that are drought adapted. They're not exactly adapted to here because the Chumash and Salinan cultures were not based on the cultivation of corn. But once you get into the desert areas and from there east, you start to find cultures that did cultivate corn. Obviously, if we're going to ever develop locally adapted varieties of corn that are adapted to our low rainfall, to maybe being watered infrequently but deeply during the summer when we don't get the summer rain they do in most of the places where they do have corn cultivation. If we're going to get locally adapted corn for each of the regions of this county, the way it happens is by the close attention of the growers saving their seeds from year to year, studying which plants are producing the best, saving the seeds only from those plants. And over time, with great patience, you start to develop locally adapted varieties. That's how it's done. That's how it's been done throughout the history of cultivation. That's how we have corn that has ears like this and is productive. The ancestral plant had ears like this. It takes time. What it needs is protection from interference and interruption. And BT pollen is interference and interruption. It also introduces the heavy hand of the corporation to actually come in and take possession of what no one should be able to possess, which is what the wind carries on to your land. So please do all you can to protect those who wish to be sustainable and in tune with our climate from anything that would stand in their way. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Linda Hall, followed by George Rosenberger.
Good morning. I'm Linda Hall, and I was going to speak about a different item briefly, but I, too, want to put my 2 cents worth in about the bacteria toxin, the BT corn. That's what I can remember, anyway. I certainly can't remember the real name. You always kind of go back to what you know, and I was an economics accounting major, and I just don't buy corn anymore unless I've got all these nice labels that say triple checked by all these different agencies and none of the GMOs and all the other stuff that I prefer to try to stay away from. And, of course, with the economics background, I'm aware of the fact that if people just quit buying the stuff, that would solve the problem. Anyway, people are in business. The other thing I really wanted to make a comment about is, and maybe Ms. Bianchi, you can, I can't read all the newspapers, and just comment on when the Main Street Enhancement Project is now projected to be finished. And I'm wondering if they're still going to build that island across from Tampson Drive. And also kind of questioning that wall that went up. Looks like a nice seawall, but it's under Dane Burwell's house. And I understand that the tenant did not want to see the hill fall down under the house, although the house will be demolished when the corporation takes over and builds the lodging facility that they plan. And it just seems that the sidewalk would have been about equal price, and they could have just gone ahead and done what they had planned, but whatever. I guess what I'm asking is what the projection is, and specifically, do you know if those islands are still planned across from Tampson Drive? I think that's it. Thanks.
Thank you for your comments. George Rosenberger.
Great. There's somebody. Help has arrived, George.
There we go.
Good morning. George Rosenberger, General Services. I've got some sad news, which I believe some of your board members already know, and I know it made the TV and the printed media in today's paper, but the infamous courthouse rooster has been stolen. It disappeared sometime last week. Our suspicions are that it was Thursday night last week, but we can't say for sure. The rooster goes back in time with the county's history. It adorned the predecessor old courthouse, the 1873 courthouse, and in fact, at one time was the subject of a column that was written in the Tribune about the goings-on in the courthouse, and it was called Under the Courthouse Rooster. The rooster is, as you can see from the picture, sat at the apex of the 1940 courthouse. It was an oversized rooster. It's about 2.5 foot long and about 18 inches high. It was actually made out of copper, and it was gold leafed. About 25 years ago, it was stolen. And fortunately, at that point in time, we, through a local radio show, it was returned anonymously to the county with no repercussions. And we had it re-gold leafed and replaced it up on top of the courthouse. And unfortunately, it's met the same fate a second time. I would appreciate your board's support and the public out there listening that if anyone has any information about the rooster, that the county would like to have it returned. It is an important part of the county's history. I know of nothing else that exists that goes back that far in time as far as county facilities are concerned. And we're asking people to call Crime Stoppers, which is 549-STOP. That's 549-STOP. And apparently they'll take information anonymously, or you can call County General Services at 781-5200, and we would appreciate any help we can get in the return of the rooster. And thanks to Supervisor Linthal for his support. And yesterday when I was struggling with exactly what to do with this, he was Mr. Retired Sergeant on the spot with all the suggestions of how we might approach this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I assume at this time, if it's returned anonymously, there will be no repercussions, right?
That would be the intent, yes.
Yeah. So if anyone's listening, knows where it is, they can call 781-5200, our General Services Department, and make arrangements to return it. And that would be most helpful and most appreciated. Okay, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to address the board? And at this time, to respond to Linda Hall's request for information, I would suggest that she contact Public Works Department for a full response on what in the world is going on with Main Street Enhancement, because I don't think I have enough time right now. It's been a trip, let me put it that way. With that, I will close it to the public for public comment. We will move on to the consent agenda. And I have two request to speak forms from the public on consent agenda. The first is Ann McMahon. The second is Mary Ann Vasconcellos.
Thank you, Chairman Bianchi and Board. My name is Ann McMahon. I'm from Santa Margarita. I'm here to speak on item B4. I just wanted to thank your board for your willingness to draft letters and send them off to our congressional representatives on behalf of the Central Coast RC&DC. I'm actually here representing the Central Coast Meat Alliance, Homegrown Meat Alliance, one of the many local groups representing small farmers and ranchers who have benefited dramatically from the assistance of the local RC&DC, and just wanted to thank you for them. They're out working on the ranch this morning, so they couldn't be here, but there's many small ranchers and farmers across the Central Coast who are currently involved in a variety of efforts to find more creative ways to market their products, and the Central Coast RCNDC has been absolutely invaluable to them in those efforts. So thanks again for your support.
Thank you. Mary Ann Vasconcellos.
Good morning. I'm Mary Ann Vasconcellos, and I've been a board member of the Resource Conservation and Development Council of the Central Coast for a number of years. I really want to thank you in advance for sending letters of support for continued funding to both Congress and the Senate. The Council, as you probably know, works to sustain the good health of our watersheds and our diverse natural resources here in the county through cooperative efforts in both conservation and development. The RCND of the Central Coast is headquartered in Morro Bay, and so probably the lion's share of their staff time really goes to benefit our county directly. Last year alone, some of their projects included helping with the Upper Salinas Los Tablas Wildlife Conference. A handbook was published on the Pismo Lake watershed. They have, as Ann said, spent numerous hours working with the Homegrown Meat Alliance. They've been helping with the Pitch Canker Task Force. They've played a leading role in the steelhead restoration projects on both Pennington and Toro Creek. They've helped with the Nipomo Sustainable Garden, co-sponsored the conference on oaks in the changing California landscape, helped get the water quality short course off the ground, have provided funding to UC for studies in the use of birds in vineyard insect control, and worked on riparian enhancement on Toro Creek. And they provide staff for the San Luis Obispo Ag Roundtable. And in addition to that, they've provided staff for two projects that are near and dear to my heart. One is the fairly rapidly growing Central Coast Ag Tourism Council, which markets its member farms and ranches to visitors so that visitors can learn more about agricultural life in our county and find a way to add additional income to their farm and ranch operations. This is a great new growing trend. It's not to be confused, Supervisor Bianchi, with resort development in the rural areas of our county, such as Pozo. We'd love to talk to you sometime about the Ag Tourism Council because it's been quite successful in areas of the United States and actually in the world. They also have provided staff to the fledgling San Luis Obispo County Buy Fresh, Buy Local network, which is also made up of family farmers and ranchers who are trying to direct market their products to our county in an effort to open up more niche markets for the survival of their farms and ranches, but also to provide some additional economic vitality to our county and additional healthy options for our county residents. I belong to a variety of agencies and help with a variety of agencies, and I can't think of a single one, with all due respect to the ones I belong to, which have done so much on behalf of resource conservation and agriculture in our county. And I think I can't thank you enough for fighting to continue funding for the Central Coast RCND Council and the great staff, Jeff Rodriguez and Lillian Phillips, who continue exceptional work here.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. I would like to add on this one that the RCND Council covers San Luis Obispo, Monterey, San Benito, Santa Barbara, Santa Cruz, and Santa Clara counties. It's an excellent organization. With that, I have no other request to speak forms on the consent agenda.
Just going to move approval.
Oh, okay.
Second.
Well, I have to find out if anybody else wants to say anything. Harry?
I was going to say nice try, Jim.
Mike.
I don't have any.
Jim, do you have any comments?
Just a comment again on B4. I would like to read into the record or just announce that the San Luis Obispo County Farm Bureau also submitted a letter of support for our letters of support going to Washington, and that was signed by Joy Fitchhugh.
Thank you. Jerry, anything?
Thank you. Second the motion.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. May we have a roll call, please?
Well, who seconded it? Thank you.
Mr. Asajian.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Asajian?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mr. Yankee?
Yes. Okay, with that, we will move on to our regular public hearings. May we have an introduction of item C1, please?
Item C1 is a hearing to consider an appeal by Elizabeth Bailey on behalf of the Pozo Community Group of the Planning Commission's decision to approve conditional use permit D000359D Jeff Nelson/Oak Creek Ranch to allow the development of a resort with 20 guest rooms, accessory structures, employee housing, and up to 5 events per year with 125 person per event, 5th District. This item was continued from February 15, 2005. Resolution is, a recommendation is to adopt the resolution upholding the appeal.
Thank you very much. May we have a staff report, please?
Madam Chair, members of the board, John Bissell, County Planning Staff. This was an appeal from the Planning Commission, as was stated, was before your board on February 15th. At that time, your board considered the recommendation of the Planning Commission, the comments from staff, comments from the applicant, comments from the appellant, and comments from members of the public, other members of the public, and your board voted to adopt the resolution upholding the appeal and reversing the decision of the Planning Commission and disapproving the application of Jeff Nelson, Oak Creek Ranch, for conditional use permit D000359D, and you directed staff to return with findings to uphold the appeal, and we have done that. I also have a letter that was received yesterday from Mr. Nelson that you all have a copy of, I believe. I don't have any specific comments on that, but I would be happy to answer any questions if you have questions. That would conclude my presentation on this.
Are there any questions of staff by board members? I see no lights. So with that, we will open it to the public. This is not strictly an appeal, is it?
Yes, it is an appeal.
Okay. With that, I will ask the appellant to, if the appellant wishes to make a statement. Okay, Charlie. Because we've had great testimony before, I'm going to limit this to 5 minutes. Usually I give everyone 10, but this is the second time around, so you get 5.
Thank you, Madam Chair, board members. Charlie Whitney on behalf of the appellants and the Pozo Community Group. I don't even know that we need to respond, but we got this letter from Mr. Nelson at the 11th hour, so to speak. We do feel that some kind of response and statement is in order. Late yesterday afternoon, the Pozo Community Group received copies of the appellant's letter of response to the findings and offer of additional mitigation. Given the limited time frame, it is difficult, though hardly necessary, to respond adequately to such ambiguous ramblings. It is often said the devil is in the details, and it is altogether too easy to get lost while responding to what appears to be the product of an active imagination. Brief analysis reveals a document which we believe littered with half-truths, omissions.
Charlie, we don't do personal comments.
Okay. I don't know how to address this any other way. I'm trying to address the letter, basically, is what I'm doing. We don't believe the letter is accurate that the applicant has submitted. And all I can do is respond to that portion of the letter where he mentions me and just tell you that it is a complete fabrication. There is some truth to what he said, but it is not accurate. And I think that reflects to credibility. This is a 17-page document that he has submitted to the county, which essentially blames everybody else for the shortcomings and the failures of the project. Basically, the Pozo Community Group appreciates the efforts of the county staff and concurs with the findings. We urge a vote to pass the resolution, uphold the appeal, and the supporting findings. After reading the most recent document from the applicant, I began reminiscing of my first days in the military many years ago during boot camp when my drill sergeant would holler at me, "Private Whitney, everybody's out of step but you." Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. The applicant has 5 minutes, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you. Jeff Nelson, on behalf of the Nelson family, who's the applicant. You got my letter, and I'll just hit some high points here. First,
And please remember, yes, we do not make personal comments.
No, that's, yes, yeah, I had no intention of doing that. First off, on the what we're trying to do here and what we have here, we are proud of what we have. We think what we're doing is a good thing, and we're proud of what we have proposed because we think it's a good thing for the county. We've had many great uses of our property over our 16 years of ownership. We have credible and widespread support, principally from people who have actually experienced the property, and those are many people locally and elsewhere also. Every one of them, in hearing about the opposition and the county's action, are actually, they just don't understand it. They can't believe it. Every one of them has said they have to see it to understand what you've got, what you do there. And unfortunately, that has not been the case here, where people have this view of what we're doing, and it's been crafted by various people's spin or concerns. And everyone who's seen it has said, this is a nice thing you're doing, one of the good things in San Luis Obispo County. Having a yoga retreat there should not be threatening to anyone. A church retreat, we've had many church retreats, that should not be threatening to anyone. For church people to walk on our trails in the morning before breakfast, that should not be threatening to anyone. Nonprofit groups, corporate groups, the president of USC wanted to come and do a leadership seminar there for his in-house people. We didn't have enough rooms to accommodate them. That would not be a bad thing for San Luis Obispo County if he was to do such a thing. I've been in this business for a long time, and vocal neighbors are not always right. I've been in every single project I've ever been involved in. Neighbors have great concern, been against a change in the status quo. Everything I've done has ultimately been approved and built, even after initial denials, and everything has been acclaimed afterwards by the neighborhood, saying this is good for our neighbor. No one has ever, after all the dust has settled, ever said when I've done something that's not good for our community. So do I feel bad about what we're proposing? No, I think many people in San Luis have said this is a great thing you're doing for the county, and if you don't believe it, so be it. But I believe that in my heart, and our whole family and our users believe that in our hearts. The denial is based on specific facts: water, traffic, fire safety. We went through a process of 3 years and 10 months to have all those facts reviewed by the staff, by outside consultants who had to do all these reports, by the Morrow Group, by CDF. So when all is said and done at the end of the 3 years and 10 months, they say, okay, you have addressed those issues to our satisfaction. You have addressed water. You have addressed traffic. You have addressed fire safety. So how are we? So what do we do then at the end? And the neighbors say, well, that doesn't work for us. We're in a position where, what do we do then? Well, if it's really facts that you're concerned about, let us address those with additional things, additional proof of water, additional mitigation measures on fire safety. So we came up with this in consultation with some other people who had suggestions. They said, why don't you propose giving your land across Park Hill, it's 3 acres, to CDF for a fire station or a substation there so that response time is better. And I said, well, let's do better, and actually let's offer to build a CDF substation there or a community fire station. So we had addressed everything up till the point of the supervisor's hearing on everything that we're supposed to address with all of the technical people. You say that's not enough. It doesn't work for the community. So we're offering one more thing here as something to extend an olive branch to say, okay, let's see if we can do something else that would benefit the community at large. So I'm just saying we feel very what we're doing is a good thing for the county, and every single one of our users has said this is a good thing for the county. It's one of the good things in the county, and if we could have more rooms, we could even have better users, and all of those uses are basically inside uses, meetings during the day, not threatening to anyone.
And your time is up.
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I will open it to the public. I have one request to speak form. If anyone else wishes to speak, if they could turn in a the
yellow slip.
At the end of public comment, the applicant will have three minutes to respond, and the appellant will have 3 minutes to respond. Since this is the second time around, Eric Greening is first, followed by Otto Schmidt.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I can't make any intelligent comments on a 17-page letter that I haven't seen. However, I can comment that your action was a month ago. The date of this hearing was known a month ago. And if a letter was actually intended to be substance for deliberation on issues, it should have come in time to have been made part of the staff report so that your board and the public could be addressing it intelligently. Since that has not happened, I think we should simply disregard that letter and proceed with what's in front of you. And what's in front of you is findings which can actually be found. And so I urge you to adopt those findings and adopt the resolution. There are a couple of lingering issues. One has to do with the illegal grading that has happened on site. And I guess one question is the pond an illegal nuisance that has to be abated, or has the pond become habitat? What is the pond right now? What is the status of any enforcement error actions that might or might not have taken place? And essentially, what is the motivation for people not to do illegal grading or illegal changes to a stream course? The other issue I would like to raise is that one thing that came out of the hearing loud and clear last month is that the inland areas are just as prone to problems with vacation rentals as the coastal areas. We don't have the density of such uses at this time, but it's something that could get rolling in an inland neighborhood just as easily as it can on the coastal side. And so I would ask that you agendize at least a discussion as to whether it's appropriate to move forward on extending the vacation rental ordinance or some variant thereof to cover the entire county. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Eric. Otto Schmidt, followed by Amelia Alvarez-Harris.
Good morning. I am Otto Schmidt, property owner and resident of the Park Hill area. Again, I must ask this board to use common sense and its authority to deny this major density impacting sprawl and expanding project and protect the public trust expressed through local petitions, advisory council directives, private correspondence, and public testimonies. The major added ingress, egress of traffic on this minimally constructed and maintained country road with numerous blind curves, blind hilltops, and many constricted single-lane passes will do nothing but increase the danger, along with negatively impacting the local ag production and fire and emergency response to our rural area in this extremely high fire hazard neighborhood. Lastly, may I again remind you that in 1985, the Los Politas fire was gone and out of control within 20 minutes, and it destroyed 90,000 acres, burned into the city limits of San Luis Obispo, and took 11 days to contain. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Amelia Alvarez-Harris, followed by Elizabeth Fadley.
Yes, my name is Amelia Alvarez-Harris, and I live at 590 Park Hill Road. All the issues have been addressed. There have been findings of fact and conclusions of law. The project is essentially a dead beat horse. I would, as an attorney, he knows that making unsubstantiated allegations is hearsay, and that's what all this is. nothing. Nothing substantive that you can put your hands on and say, oh, good, this is something we can act on. No, nothing. I would urge you to please uphold the appeal and render your judgment. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Elizabeth Fadley, followed by Sandra Parker.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth Fadley, and I've resided at 770 Park Hill Road for the past 22 years. And I'm just here to thank the board for their initial tentative vote to uphold the appeal, and I sincerely hope that that will be your vote, your remaining vote, your final vote today, and to preserve the quality of our neighborhood, and we appreciate all the time and effort that it has taken to come to this decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Sandra Parker.
My name is Sandra Parker. I live on Werewero near Park Hill. I also urge you to uphold the appeal. Mr. Nelson's personal desires for his financial and personal gains should be considered somewhat, but not more than the greater good of a huge amount of people in a vast area. It is rural, it is agricultural, and for all the reasons you heard before, it still seems to make good sense that you uphold this appeal. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. I have no other... I do. We have an incoming yellow slip. Francis Baker.
From 685 Park Hill, we'd like to ask you again to uphold the appeal. It's been stated many times in many ways that we are mean-spirited and ignorant people, that we do not know what's good for us. We'd like to tell you that indeed we do. Many of us have been in the area over 100 years. Our families have developed and improved property, and we appreciate your careful consideration in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. With that, I will close it to the general public, bring it back to the applicant who has 3 minutes, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you. First, as to our submittal, I started a draft after the hearing, and I started basing it on some of the comments. Then I thought, well, what are they actually going to deny this on? What's the basis for the denial? How can I do a letter until I see the denial? So I asked for Mr. Bucell for a copy of the findings for a denial, and I got them faxed to me at the end of the day Thursday. So I put together this final letter as soon as possible, because a letter that didn't address what the actual findings were would have been inappropriate, because it's not addressing what is before the board now. So that's why we got to that, and that's why it includes some things that are not in the findings but had been discussed by the board also. And what those are actually a lot of factual things, and I followed up with some neighbors too on factual things, where a neighbor came and said, I think he testified, I saw uses from people off of your property that are on my property that was a result of your guess. And I talked to him, and we went over it, and he said, okay, I agree that that is not true. In fact, I was wrong on that. So that was a fact. He was telling you that, and in fact, he was wrong on that fact. A lot of these other things are facts, the water, the traffic. The reason Mr. Bucell has such a big file here, and why my file is like this on this, is that you ask people to go through and pin down a lot of facts on water, on traffic, et cetera. And so if you're going to have that process where you have all these, get into all the facts, and then it's denied on the facts, and in fact, the people who are analyzing those facts have already signed off on those facts, what's an applicant to do? If the real deal is that you have to get all your neighbors to sign off on an application that's consistent with zoning, then you should change the process so that you get people to sign off on it up front, rather than go through this 3-year, 10-month process of identifying the facts. And then some neighbors come out of the woodwork and are against us. There's no question about that. Others who are are okay with us, and they're not as motivated to come here and talk to you. We have people who say, okay, I think that's good for the neighborhood, but I've got a life. I'm not going to come here and talk to the supervisors. So ultimately, it comes down to you're denying out on a bunch of facts that your people who are trained to analyze these have already signed off on. And that's just, I don't think that's right. I just don't think it's right. And it's not a good end of the process. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Charlie Whitney.
Charlie Whitney, again, thank you for the opportunity to respond. We didn't know you were going to have kind of another hearing today on this item, so I'm going to make this real brief. The process has been followed as it's laid out. We went through all of the procedures as we were supposed to. We addressed the issues. The board voted on the issues. They have submitted their vote to the planning department for findings. We hope that you will uphold the appeal, that you will agree with the findings, and that you will adopt the resolution that's before you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your comments. With that, I'm going to close it to the public. We'll bring it back to the board for discussion and or action. Mr. Patterson.
Yes, Madam Chair. I would just like to make a couple of points. First of all, the original project had 61 conditions attached to it, many of them revolving around issues of water and traffic and fire and some of those things that were discussed today. And I don't see any substantial change in those conditions. There was questions about traffic safety. The project is too large and therefore incompatible with the surrounding zoning and surrounding areas. I wanted to mention that really what the issues assessed were a proposed escalation in use of the project, having events with as many as 125 persons, as well as the people that were staying over at the resort. And it was conditioned on things that really were not enforceable. So I don't think it's practical to allow that sort of use in a situation like this. And having seen no substantial change, I at this point move that we adopt the resolution upholding the appeal and accept the findings as presented by staff.
Do we have a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. May we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. With that, and thank you for your self-control back there. With that, we will take a 10-minute break and return at 17 minutes after with item C2. Is coming back into session, so if everyone would please take his or her seat. May we have an introduction of item C2, please.
Item C2 is a hearing to consider an appeal of the Planning Commission's disapproval of the King Ventures appeal of the Planning Commission determination that the as-built guardhouse and gate structure are not allowed within the 500-foot setback required pursuant to Heritage Ranch Village Area Plan Standard 10E, the First District recommendations as to for denial of the appeal.
Thank you. And may we have a staff report.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the board. Martha Nieder, County Planning. The appellant constructed this gate structure and guardhouse without a permit approximately 150 feet from the center line of Lake Nacimiento Drive. Staff determined that the gate structure and guardhouse could not be permitted in its current location due to a planning area standard which required an open space setback of 500 feet from the center line of Lake Nacimiento Drive for all development parcels, fences, primary and accessory structures. This slide shows the relation of the construction to the 500-foot setback. Oh, I'm sorry. Now it shows. the construction with relation to the 500-foot setback. Here's a site plan. And here's a couple pictures. Here's a close-up and one from the distance. This picture is from Lake Nacimiento Drive. The intent of the 500-foot setback is to protect the scenic quality of Lake Nacimiento Drive, which is a designated federal scenic highway. And this standard requiring the 500-foot setback has been interpreted with some latitude. Here is an example of some of the fences and gates along this road. And many of these are ranch-style fences and gates. Some of them were constructed for the keeping of animals, and then even much of the fencing and gates that weren't constructed specifically for animals were still typically constructed in an open ranch-style manner. County staff and the public have been of the general opinion that these open ranch-style fences and gates did not warrant strict interpretation of the standard since they retained the rural ranching character of the area. Recently, some of the gate structures began to push the envelope related to their size and massiveness, and some of the entrances became solid masonry entrances. However, most of the gate structures still have not exceeded 7 feet in height, and none include a guardhouse. The as-built guardhouse and gate structure shown here for track 1910 has clearly crossed the line due to the massiveness of the gate structure, which is close to double the size of others, and the inclusion of the guardhouse. The increased massiveness and the scale of the guardhouse and gate structure are inconsistent with the intent of the scenic setback. King Ventures appealed the planning director's determination that the planning area standard required a 500-foot setback, and at their January 13, 2005 hearing, the Planning Commission found the following. The first is that the planning area standard does apply. They determined that the gate shed structure is to be removed and the utilities located to within or behind the gate structure. They found that the gate structure should be redesigned so its massing is equal to or less than that of the gate structure. Sorry, I'm having technical difficulties. The gate structure shown here, which is at 9675 Lake Nacimiento Drive, it's the largest other structure within the 500-foot setback. They determined that the gate structure is to be located as close to the 500-foot setback line as feasible, and that King Ventures, the Heritage Ranch Homeowners Association, and planning staff are to work together towards an acceptable design within these parameters. John King appealed that decision based on the following issues. The first is that the gate is required for track security. And staff's response is that the Planning Commission's motion includes allowances for a security gate. The second issue of the appeal is that the gate scale is appropriate for an entrance of 150-lot residential subdivision. The Planning Commission established parameters for gate scale that they thought was appropriate, and that is it be equal to or less than the massing of the gate structure shown here. The third issue of the appeal is that locating the gate behind the 500-foot setback would create a hardship, encroach on residential lots, and that there is no room for a turnaround. And again, the Planning Commission's motion allows for the gate to be constructed within the 500-foot setback. The final issue of the appeal is that the gate is unfinished, and it will be an asset when landscaped. Landscaping will not reduce the massive appearance of the guardhouse and gate structure to the extent that it will appear consistent with other gate structures in the area or the intent of the scenic setback. In conclusion, staff recommends denial of the appeal based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and that the Planning Commission's decision be upheld, which is shown on this slide here. Thank you, and I'm available for questions.
Are there any questions of staff? Yes, Mr. Ovid.
One question you brought up in your testimony is you said the Planning Commission would agree to the fence being within the 500-foot setback?
Right. They directed it to be moved as close to the 500-foot setback as feasible, but recognized that there are topographical and other constraints.
What I'm saying is that they're allowing it to be on the road within. Yeah, thank you.
Are there any other questions of staff? Oh, I have one. You mentioned that the gate is to be there for track security, but my understanding is there's no fence extending beyond the edges of this gate. So what's secure?
The appellant stated that it was for track security, so I think he would be better to address that question.
Thank you. I see no other light, so with that, I will open it to the public. This is an odd situation because the applicant, I guess, is the staff has already given the, you know, one side of the presentation, so the appellant will go next, and the appellant has 10 minutes.
Good morning, Chairman Bianchi, members of the board. My name is David Watson. I'm here on behalf of King Ventures. We're here today to try to solicit your assistance in resolving a matter of interpretation as we view it. We're here because we built the gate and we built the fence around the gate at a time in which we felt that the buildings, and as we understood it, didn't require a county permit. The building is less than 100 square feet, and the fence itself averages 6 feet in height, with the exception of the pilaster light features or cupolas that extend.
Excuse me, but the lights will go for 5 minutes and then go back on for 5 minutes. So when you see the first red light, ignore
it. Don't get uptight? Okay. I'll do my best. We're also here because, as I understood the motion that was made at the Planning Commission meeting, there was a lot of wrestling with the absolute black and white nature of the 500-foot setback. The Commission's motion, with all due respect, as I recall it, was that they found that the policy was applicable to this type of a structure. The Commission then encouraged us, with facilitation at staff's part, to work on these four or five different action items that they presented in their staff report. But I think the Commission tried as best they could to work within the requirement that this is either an absolute requirement or a requirement that has to have some flexibility. And really, it's your policy, so that's why we're really here today. With regard to the staff report on page 2, I'd like to highlight essentially the five action items that the Commission and staff made suggestions about back at the hearing as a means to try to resolve these issues today. There are three of those that I'd like to focus on, the middle three, if you will. First, we are willing to remove the utility structure, the gatehouse, as it has been referred to, that sits in the center of the cul-de-sac. That structure is the largest of the structures, as you can tell from the photographs. We would remove that. We would like to replace that with an oak tree and some landscaping. We will need a pedestal 3.5 to 4 feet high to allow a car to come in and punch a keypad, which would provide entrance through the gate if they did not have an opener. Secondly, staff has suggested that we redesign the gate and the fence to be no larger than the residential structure at, I think it's 9675, although I'll stand corrected, Nacimiento Drive, in the photograph they had before we came up here. That gate was built last year, and it was built within the 500-foot setback, and as you can see, this standard has not been uniformly applied, and so we're searching for a common ground or a compromise that hopefully we can reach today. Let me make a few comments about that particular entry feature so we can keep all this in context. That gate serves a single residential access, and I think the gate's somewhere between 12 and 16 feet wide, as a driveway is permitted to be for a single residential home. The entry that we're talking about serves obviously 150 residential lots, something substantially different in terms of scale, frequency of access, and therefore the way in which the gate's going to operate is going to be very different. It also serves the CSD's water delivery facilities that exist down near the lake below the dam. If you look at the gate structure in the photographs that we had handed out earlier, and the staff has supplied, the road itself is 28 feet wide, and it provides for two-way access. So it is twice as wide as a residential access driveway that you saw in the suggested compromise. Because we're required to build a 28-foot wide street, and we have two gates that slide back and forth, that necessarily is going to be substantially larger than the photograph that you have of the residential driveway. As was pointed out, we also constructed, as you can see in the plans and the photographs, an 80-foot wide diameter turnaround. That cul-de-sac or turnaround was created, obviously, to provide for turnarounds for vehicles that might come to the gate but inaccurately looking for another location. Also for cars that are going to come down G14 or Lake Nacimiento Drive and they might want to go back, they might have missed an access or missed where their destination was. It also was designed to provide for fire and emergency vehicle access in and around this cul-de-sac. So that's why the dimension and the size of the entry is as large as it happens to be. The fencing detail on the plan and as-built photograph, I should say, of the Nacimiento home are similar. They're very similar. In fact, they have fences that come from cupolas and that arch up towards the main gate feature itself. When taking all of these issues into consideration, we'd encourage you to look at the scale of what is being served by our access gate in relationship to what we've been required to do in terms of the conditions for the track. The third matter comes down to the feasibility of moving the gate further back. And I think the issue, from our perspective, there are three significant reasons why it is not possible to move the gate back a little bit or a lot further back to the end of the 500-foot setback. First, the slope of the ground, as you look at the plans, begins to increase and rolls away from the entry gate as it is. When it was installed, we found the flattest area we could to be able to create the least amount of disturbance possible. Secondly, there is a water course that was very prominent in the approval of the track that needed to be maintained in a natural condition that runs along the southern boundary of the access drive, which again you'll see in some of the exhibits that have been provided. The amount of grading and earthwork that would be necessary to move a giant, if we just literally picked it up and moved it back in 80-foot diameter, would just be disruptive to that water course and require substantial more grading than most people might appreciate. Lastly, we feel very strongly that the entry feature provides a point of reference for people to come in and out of the development. And in that context, if you move back to the east below the hill, you're moving that visibility or that visual connection between the traveler and that entry location, you're taking that away. And if that is less or not visible from the street, we think that's a detriment to the purpose for having the entry in the first place. And as an aside, moving it closer to a couple of the residential lots there, I know are not in the interest of the people that own those lots at the 500-foot setback. So I think what we're here to try to discuss today and offer up is some sort of a compromise that would address the purpose behind the policy without necessarily having to be black and white at 500 feet. We've reflected upon the original purpose of the condition. It was visual. It was to try to lessen the impact of features along the scenic highway. And we've provided, and I believe it's on the counter for you, some exhibits, some photographic exhibits, which show a couple of visual simulations as to what, and I don't know if that's possible to put on the overhead, but what possibly could be done if we remove the utility entry feature building and we tone down the color. The paint right now is kind of a light tan, grayish tone color. It stands out in terms of the natural backdrop of grasses and trees a little bit more than might be necessary. So one of the photo exhibits simulates the idea of taking that structure out and creating a darker earth tone to the fence, repainting it basically. There's a couple of views that show that, and then there's also a plan that shows the landscape plan that we had always envisioned installing but have not been able to complete because when this issue came forward, we halted any work on the project. Madam Chair and Supervisors, I think it's our desire this morning to try to work with you, to work with the community, to work with the members that reside essentially within the track, who we believe are overwhelmingly in favor of maintaining the gate and trying to find some sort of a compromise that would work in the directions I've suggested today. I do have a couple of copies of some letters and petitions that we've received from residents within the tract. They represent over 50 lot owners within the development. I'll just pass those out through your legal staff in support of trying to find a way to retain the gate and to move past this and get a solution that works for all of us. So we stand at the ready. I've got a little bit more time I'll leave for you to use. And I think what we're looking for today is your solemn wisdom to try to help us resolve these disagreements.
Okay. I have one question, Mr. Shajan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Watson, looking at the before and after pictures, quite an accomplishment there. Have you considered on the second one, the one below, to have an open fence rather than a solid to look even closer to the neighborhood's fence?
If, for example, a wrought iron fence as opposed to the...
No, just if you, some of the other wooden fence, they had an opening, wrought iron was solid.
If that were the commission's or the board's desire, we could work with that. We're, the landscape plan that we've shown actually will do much to really hide most of the fence. The trees, the bushes, the landscaping that we've proposed, we think will do a lot to actually inhibit view of what now really is an unfinished structure. So I don't know that the fence itself was intended to keep people from driving around the gate, because people will have a tendency once they get there, if they can't figure out how to get in, to try to find a way to get in. Chair Bianchi raised that question in her comments as well about, is it secure? There is a split rail fence that runs up to the entry feature that's there now. And if our landscaping can't impede access from where it terminates now, if our landscaping around the cul-de-sac doesn't impede access, then we could consider extending that white fence a little bit further up to this side. I'd leave it to you to decide if you feel that that would make a significant difference in the visual look. I think the landscaping will do more to really hide it.
But as far as you're concerned, if it was open or solid as it is, that wouldn't interfere if it's your purpose is to serve security or safety
As providing security, I think open or wrought iron or interrupted fence would do the same thing. I might add a postscript. The design that's on this fence now is a design that's reflective of an application that we've made to the planning department for the commercial center that's across the street. It's a 5-acre development within Heritage Ranch that has a commercial plan that's in process now, and it's a heavy board and bat finish similar to what you see here. Without having it out there, nobody recognizes the connection now between the two, but our intention was to try to create some architecture and some statements out here that create a little bit more homogeneous look to the area as opposed to what you've seen maybe in the past. So that was the intent for the style that was constructed.
Thank you. Mr. Ovitt?
Your best estimate, what's the elevation difference between Nusmina Lake Road and this? It's about 10 feet?
Probably about 8 to 10 feet, somewhere in that.
10 feet different elevation, vertical. So this is lower.
A little bit lower, yeah.
Yeah, and I was thinking that when you look at the pictures that were shown on the other gates, they're on the upper side, and that also tends to reduce mass.
Okay, I see no other light, so thank you very much. You'll have an opportunity to respond.
Thank you.
With that, I will open it to the public. I have several requests to speak forms, but what I'll do is I will call one name. That person can go to one or the other microphone. I'll call a second name, and then you can just alternate back and forth. And I think you've recognized, for those of you who have not been here before, that we have these lights face me. We have the light over there. The first 2 minutes will be a green light, and then at the end of that, a yellow light comes on, and that warns you that you should start concluding your statement. And when the red light comes on, yes, you will conclude your statement. You don't need to fill up the entire 3 minutes if you don't care to. So with that, first speaker is Scott Baker, and the second is Dwayne Clausen. David? Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Scott Baker. I'm counsel for Heritage Ranch Owners Association. We have submitted a position paper to the board this morning that outlines our primary concern, and that is that whatever decision the board makes today, it should not be based on a comparison of the subject gate with other fences along Highway G14. And the reason for that is that the present specific plan paragraph that applies to the subject gate did not exist in its present form when those other properties were developed. There was no prohibition against fences, and there was no designation of the 500-foot setback as open space. So we're dealing with a completely different situation regarding the subject gate and the property it's on. It's on property that has now been designated as open space and deeded to the Homeowners Association. and it is also subject to this prohibition, specifically with respect to fences, which the previous development and the lots on those developments were not. So the subject gate is now on HROA property. It's on a roadway that is going to be dedicated to HROA for maintenance, and this gate will ultimately be subject to HROA responsibility for maintenance. And that brings me to the second point that we are concerned about, and that is the potential safety issues that might arise from the placement of this gate so close to Highway G14. It's less than 150 feet, and we can envision a situation where, because of the gate being closed, traffic backing up, that there could be a safety issue with respect to traffic on Highway G14. Since the Homeowners Association will be the owners of the gate, will be the owners of the roadways and the open space that this all sits on, we're very concerned about liability with respect to any safety issues or potential accidents that may happen as a result of the proximity of the gate to Highway G14. Those are the concerns that we have at this point. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. David Clausen, followed by Gordon Laughlin.
Yes, my name is David Clausen. I live at 9353 Nassmanna Lake Drive. I'm a fourth generation of the Clausens that have lived on the Nassmanna property. My great-grandfather homesteaded there more than 100 years ago. I have a daughter that's preparing to, they've gotten their permit, in fact, to build in Track 1910, which is the developer's property. We bought them a lot about 2 years ago so that they could build their home near us. We're on a 20 on the opposite side of the highway. But we have one of those electric gates up front with concrete and plaster and so forth. It's been there for quite some time. Trying to compare these gates to individual homes with something of a major subdivision is like trying to compare a blimp with a golf ball. It's ridiculous. That thing is an abomination. It had no thought put into it with the CCNRs and the people of Heritage Ranch. Nobody was asked their opinion of any of it. The developer went in there without a permit and built it and blatantly tried to shove it down our throat. It's an absolute abomination. It's unsafe. It does not provide adequate room for people to get off the road. Going into our individual ranches is different than going in where there's 151 home sites. My daughter and her children are going to have to go through that. And when they come up off of G14, it's dangerous enough as it is. And there isn't adequate room for boats and cars to be stacked up at a guard gate. That's far too close to the highway. It's a major highway safety issue. The other thing that really bothers me is the recent information that's come to us about how they were able to get some of this open space land, quote, that belongs to the rest of us. Now, there's 218 acres that has been claimed by the developer as open space ground that belongs to us. That's 25% of my ranch. At the current rate of property value, just for the people of us that own 20s and 5s, there's about $55 million worth of property that's been illegally seized for the purpose of, quote, open space for somebody else's benefit. That's not eminent domain. We were never advised of it, and it never should have gone through anybody's planning commission. I don't know how that ever got approved, if it is approved, but it's definitely going to be seriously challenged.
Thank you for your comments. Gordon Laughlin, followed by Mark Richardson.
Madam Chairperson, members of the board, good morning. Good news, I thought I was going to be the last guy, but I guess there's somebody else. Bad news, I'm one of these lawyer guys. I represent six of the 20-acre people who've donated some of their time to me. I might not be able to stop in 2 minutes, and I might exceed that.
You have three.
All right. I might even exceed that, and I'd appreciate your indulgence. The issue here is simple. It's public safety. The gatehouse, which is going to have a person in it, is going to stop vehicles going into this unit. Or we're going to have a keypad, we just heard from Dave Watson. Here's what's going to happen. I'm the last 20-acre on the left side of the highway and the closest to this gate. That's 10025 Nacimiento Drive. I see the vehicles coming by on Friday afternoon, all pulling trailers, all pulling boats. Some of them are RVs. They're stacked up. They go down to the gate at the lake. They stack up backwards all the way out to the dam. If we're going to put a stop at this place where there's 150 people, many of them having two vehicles and a boat and an RV, and they 150 people are going to have 150 friends, they're all going to want to come to the lake. We now got water in the lake. Hallelujah. Incidentally, my condolences for the rooster problem I heard about this morning. I'm sorry about that. But getting back to this, here's what the issue. Let's frame it. We have a well-connected, politically developer who wants to throw in.
We don't make personal comments here.
I'm sorry. We have a developer who's local, and we got a bunch of people out north who are in our north county. We're going to be living with this problem. And on Fridays and on Saturdays and on weekends, what's going to happen if they got a key at their entry 150 feet from a highway? That's about two trailers and a couple of boats. And this highway is G14. There's one lane each way. There isn't any off-ramp here. There isn't any pad here. There isn't any place to put all these boats and trailers. I sit there at the last one, and I can't even see. It's a blur. I can't see across the street. We got a terrible problem. We got more people coming in the county. We got everybody wanting to go there. Now, here's what he's doing, or here's what they're doing. They violated the law. They didn't get county permission. They didn't get a permit. And they're kind of drowning, but they want to pull everybody else down with them. There's a whole big deal. This is a commercial event. He said key stop. Key stop means you get out of your car with your boat or your trailer or your friend or their boat or trailer. You come up and you open the key 150 feet from the road, and then you go inside. You've stopped everybody else. The county planning commission said put it down 500 feet so that you got an entry at least. He said there's three reasons, Kim Watson, I listened to him, three reasons you shouldn't do that, because we got a slope. That doesn't prevent cars from stopping with trailers. That slope is no issue. We got a water pipe. We have to move it. They're making millions. They can move it. And the last issue, he said, visibility.
And your time is up.
All right. I can't conclude. Public safety is the most important thing for government, and that's the issue here.
Okay.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much for your comments. Mark Richardson, followed by William Larson.
Thank you. My name is Mark Richardson. I own 9980 Bluegill, which is Lot 2, which is about 500 feet in from the street. And heard a lot of comments, especially just now, about safety and such. You know, I'm just actually kind of learning about this. One of the things that really bothered me, from what I understand, is that from the Homeowner Association, they said they've contacted quite a few of the homeowners and that they did not like the gate. I don't know if it was inside the development or not. I was never contacted, and obviously somebody who could be highly affected by the placement of a gate if it's moved in that far, and I understand it doesn't necessarily need to be that far. But I was thinking about the safety situation. Where the gate is now, I don't see that it's a backup. You know, he's talking about boats, RVs, and things like that. People that live there are going to have them parked at their home, or they're going to have the boats docked at the lake. So they're not going to be running in and out all weekend long with boats, trailers, and things like that. At least that's my opinion on that. And as far as safety goes, if somebody does, if they are looking for the development, they need to be able to see the development. And if you're going on G14 there, and if you happen to miss the development, where's your next place to turn around? It's the road that goes into Lake Nacimiento just before the dam, unless you're going to do a turnout and turn out in the middle in an unsafe area. So, you know, I look at, as far as safety goes, being able to recognize the entrance when you need an entrance is very important. Unless somebody wants them to move the gate back and put up a big sign that's going to be bigger than what the entrance is now, so that people don't miss the entrance and cause other safety situations. You know, and I hope that something is resolved in some way, because as part of our homeowner association, I'm assuming that they're, in buying a piece of property in there, that you are getting some of that security. You go into the Heritage Ranch side, you do get, you know, the guards, and you do have that. So hopefully that situation does get resolved in some way or another. But I think as far as the safety goes, I think where it is with the turnout and all that, I think it's a very safe situation because you do have a lot of room for quite a few cars. When the gate opens and closes, I think it'll be quick in and out as far as I could see what I've looked at with other gates similar to that. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. William Larson, followed by Tony Egebrecht.
Good morning, Madam Chairperson and members of the Board of Supervisors. My name is William Larson. I live on Steelhead Drive in the Riverview development. I had not, along with colleagues and friends, had not been made aware of the earlier hearings. It's my understanding that the Homeowners Association had surveyed their own group, but certainly not those living in the new development. None of us were asked about the gates one way or the other. So I believe there was a representation made at a previous meeting. In terms of the gate, actually, I've circled a few things as I listen, and I realize I do have limited time. First, let me just share with you, we're not a resort. We're just folks living there. We have our homes. Goodness, and I heard some comparison of, well, our family has been here for X number of years. Mine's been here since pre-49er, so I'm not sure what relevance that has, whether our family's been living in this particular area for 100 years or more. It's not a resort. It's a community. And the they, in this case, is us. We live here. We're living here now. In terms of public safety, this was mentioned just a moment ago, those of us that have boats, we keep them in our garages. It's not a resort. We're not backed up. And all the trips I've made up here, I've never seen a backup for the gate. I wonder if the board would consider a compromise on this. If the gates have to be pushed back a bit, so be it. If they have to be reconfigured, I personally can think of a little more pleasing appearance to those gates that have already been agreed to by the developer. I guess the word, the bottom line is compromise. I think that it needs to be worked out. We do need security. It's been brought to my attention that hunters sometimes come through, and last thing I want to see, I'm not going to take a position on hunting one way or the other, but we don't want through traffic that are headed for other areas. And we do need that road security. It's true, someone can jump over a fence at any time. And that's just the way life is. But with that, I would ask that the board do consider a reasonable compromise, aesthetics and distance and all of that. But I do observe that sometimes, in this case, even the Homeowners Association taking a very rigid, one-sided position, and we're members of the Homeowners Association who have never been polled. So I repeat that a second time with intent.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Mr. Egebrecht, followed by Reed Harris.
Yes, my name is Tony Egebrecht. I live in Riverview at 9826 Steelhead Road. And I was one of the first individuals that moved into Riverview since June of last year. I would just like to add that I was not contacted by Heritage Ranch Association also of any meetings with this gate in the January meeting, I believe. The gate itself is situated, it looks like to me, about 150 feet away from the center of the divided road or the road. I have been in other communities where the traffic is the same or more with less than 150 feet. I've been in gated communities where you have a remote control, so you're able to open the gate and not even stop to continue on through. The individuals that do have to stop are usually guests that need to call in or be given a code to get in through the gate. I don't see a problem with the gated area where it's located at the present with that much room for vehicles. And actually, you can even double up in the area since they've got a big circular area there and still allow traffic to come out. So my proposal is that the gate is accepted, and with any of the conditions that are acceptable, and that a compromise could come on in regards to that fence.
Thank you for your comments. Reed Harris, followed by Bob Ballantyne.
Hello, my name is Reed Harris. I'm Vice President of Midland Pacific Homes in Atascadero, California. And we are the primary developer in Tract 1910 Riverview. We had purchased 45 lots a couple years ago. I would first like to mention that we have polled every single customer that we have out there. And I would also like to mention that we still control a number of lots, and no one has ever contacted us from the association as to whether we preferred to have the gate removed or stay. And that representation was made at the Planning Commission that all or almost all of the homeowners in our tract had been polled, and all of them wanted the gate removed. We have yet to find one person that was spoken to about this issue in our project, which is the one being discussed today. I would also like to mention that in talking to a number of people in the audience during the break, many of them believe that they are here today to keep the developer from taking 500 feet of their setback along Nacimiento Lake Drive, and many of them told me we could care less about the gate. We're here to prevent them from taking our land. So I believe there's a lot of misrepresentations taking place about this issue. As far as the gate's concerned, I would like to mention that my gate expert, who is my salesperson there, has indicated to me that the gate can be set to stay open different amounts of time depending on how we program it. If we program it, we can program the gates to open and stay open for, say, 80 seconds, which would allow a number of cars to go through so that we could prevent any backups during heavy traffic times. I would also like to mention that across the street at Heritage Ranch, there are almost 1,400 homes, and based on their theory, that gate would have to be moved as well for safety, because that would mean that they would need 10 times the distance we need in order to maintain a safe, acceptable level of traffic. I also have with me a petition, and this is the first time in my 20-year history that all of my customers have agreed on one thing, okay? And I have a petition here signed by all of my customers asking that, and we specifically on the petition wrote what they were signing so that there were no misunderstandings. And all of my customers have agreed, and some of them are here today, which is kind of a feat in itself, that they would prefer that this gate stay because that is one of the reasons they purchased their home there. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob Ballantyne, followed by Daphne Ballantyne.
Good morning. My name is Bob Ballantyne, and I live at 9850 Steelhead Road in Riverview Estates. Back in October of 2004, we purchased a house at Riverview Estates with the understanding that there'd be security gates there. We were never contacted about the previous meeting regarding the displeasure with the gates. I'm just here today to state that I'm in favor of the gates. I'm in favor of where the gate is located right now. Certainly a compromise to remove the gate house itself. I'm sure that's agreeable to a lot of people here. And my biggest concern was a lot of the misinformation I had heard and correct information I've heard that there was a potential for the gate to be removed completely. And I just want to state my position that I purchased the property with the intention of having security gates, and it's our desire to keep the gates where they're at. Thank you.
Thank you. Daphne Ballantyne, followed by Eduardo Cantu.
Hi, and thank you. I'm Daphne Ballantyne. I live at 9850 Steelhead Road, and this is the first time I've ever even heard about the gates. On Thursday, we found out there was going to be a meeting and that somebody had pulled everybody in Riverview Track, and that that there's an issue with the gates. Nobody has pulled us. Nobody has contacted us. I found out on Thursday that there was even a meeting here today, and I'm just really disappointed in the communication that has gone on. Like my husband mentioned, we purchased a home in there for security. It's behind gates. We have two small children. I don't want people coming in there hunting or riffraff or people going in and out. That's why we purchased it, and I just hope we can maintain the gate and keep the gate. If it needs to be moved a little bit back or some modifications be done, but I truly hope that the gate stays there, because that is what all of us were led to believe, and that's why we purchased homes in that area. It's a beautiful area and well-maintained. Thank you.
Thank you. Eduardo Cantu, followed by Lance Sawyer.
Good morning. My name is Eduardo Cantu, and I live at 9830 Steelhead Road. I think I was about the second person out there last year in March when I fell in love with the area. And according to our salesman, this was going to be a nice secured area. And I went ahead and put a down payment and a deposit and proceeded to keep an eye on the property. And I moved from Orange County to up here, and I thought, wow, this is going to be nice. Come Mother's Day, I presented my wife with a house on Mother's Day, saying, "This is good. We're going to live here." And she liked the idea of the gate and the security and such. That at that time there was nobody living there, just Egbert and myself, you know, in March. We started this project, and in August I moved there, and I thought, wow, this is really neat. Nobody around. And, of course, there's a lot of people going in and out. You don't know who they were at the time, you know. But the thing about it is, eventually, it's going to be all sold, a nice area, and I'm for security and that gate. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Lance Sawyer, followed by Donna Brock.
Good morning. My name is Lance Sawyer, and I live at 9946 Fly Rod Drive inside the Riverview Estates. I'm also a San Luis Obispo County PCF firefighter with Station 34 and 33 in Heritage Ranch and Oak Shores to the north. I've lived for 5 years in Oak Shores, which is also a gated community, and that's one of the reasons that I purchased the property in Riverview, is to also live in a gated community. So I am definitely for continuing to keep the gate in place. I think the pictures that have been shown are a little bit deceiving in that perhaps, as Mr. Ovid identified, the road is a little higher, so you really don't see the gate as prominently as it's displayed in the pictures. I've passed by it every day for 5 years or however long it's been in place, and it isn't anywhere near as obtrusive as it might appear in those pictures. I think the access is appropriate. I appreciate the fact that they've put the turnaround in place for vehicles, especially fire and rescue vehicles, to be able to turn around in the event you can't get through the gate for some reason. If you've ever tried turning one of those big things around, it's or backing it up a long distance, it's very difficult. The visibility of the road as you approach this is very good, so you can, if there were for some reason traffic backed up, you could see it for a long ways before you get to it. So it's not a, you know, around a blind corner or anything like that. It's very easily seen. And I look forward to working with the HROA in the future on other issues as I become more in tune with some of the issues that the association has to deal with. And I ask that you please accept and approve this project with the changes that have been proposed, as I think those are good changes and will meet with the main objections of the parties that have been involved. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Donna Brock, followed by Linda Ritchie.
Hello, I'm Donna Brock, and I am a resident at Riverview. I live at 9996 Fly Rod. And as a resident, I wanted to state my husband and I both like the gate. We would like to see that it is remains. We like the security aspect. The gate, for those of you who haven't actually seen it, it's wider than it looks in the pictures, the turnaround. It's a very nice wide turnaround that from listening to the safety aspects of the people commenting, I think the wideness of the area there and the fact that the gate can be automatically set to stay open somewhat takes away that concern of security of cars backing up. They can also turn around and go out the other way. It's a nice area there for that. Would not be in favor of it being moved back because I think the visibility from the road, it would not, you wouldn't even see it if it's placed where they're wanting it to be placed. I also work with Richardson Properties. I'm a real estate sales agent. I represent many of the custom home builders at Riverview. And I know many of the current people that live there that have bought from us and also from Midland. The comment that I see them often and talk to them often, the residents, the comments I get are that they had not been contacted for this. They were not aware that there was an issue until we, became aware of it and started sharing that. I would say, I don't know the exact percentage, but it feels close to 99% of the people I have talked to are in favor of this gate. And in fact, even some that have not signed are and did not show up today to talk, they are in favor of it staying. I hear very, very few comments negatively towards the gate, the look of the gate. If anything, some people think it's they don't like the center guard shack or whatever that is, kiosk that is there. But other than that, the look of the gate, the comments I hear that people are very, very much in favor of it, but they are almost all in favor of it staying there. I have heard no comments from these residents, the people that actually live at Riverview, that they do not want to have this gate there. So I just hope you would consider that. Thank you.
Thank you. Linda Ritchie, followed by Nona Cantalupe.
My name is Linda Ritchie. I'm the general manager of Heritage Ranch, and I spoke in January. And I didn't in any way represent that we had done any survey of the property owners. We're mixing up a couple items here. First, Heritage Ranch Owners Association didn't initiate any complaint on this gate. At that time, in the January hearing, County Council reminded us that had someone not initiated a complaint and it was later found to be illegal, it would have been our responsibility. But even so, once the roads were turned over to us, we didn't initiate any complaint. We weren't happy with the fact that they didn't go through our architectural committee, as the design of the gate surely doesn't match anything else on the ranch. We have heard lots of complaints through the office. We never went out and solicited them. Reed Harris's boss even met with us, described it as a waiting to find a soldier walkout. We've heard all sorts of unflattering comments. And the only meeting we had, and that was the issue our attorney presented today, we had a meeting, we are going around having track meetings with all the tracks, was regarding our issue, which is tying in the 20 and the 5-acre parcels in with this. And that has been our only issue we've addressed to Martha on this. It's really not our ordinance. It's you guys' ordinance, so it's none of our business, other than we are concerned about a safety issue and tying in the 5s and 8s and the 20s. And I, in fact, at the January meeting said we support keeping a gate. If it's a question of doing a survey on having a gate, I don't think anyone would object to that. We said that was promised to the property owners. It was just the liability and the location and the design of the gate. We have been providing security on a regular basis. And, in fact, we've caught some people that have been stealing out there. We have regular patrols out there. The gate has never worked. Frankly, it has never been closed. The questions we get from the property owners is, when is this gate going to start working? It has been left open, and we personally, our security goes out there and manually closes it. As far as notification, you guys, among anyone, know how difficult it is to tell a lot of people the information. It has been regularly published in our newsletter regarding exactly these meetings, and it's also been on our website. We even have a link to your planning meetings and your Board of Supervisor meetings right off of our website. There's been no intention to conceal anything from the property owners that are representing what their testimony is today. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Nona Cantalupe, followed by Constance Stewart.
Good morning. I'm Nona Cantalupo. I live in Track 1963, which is just off Nacimiento Lake Drive. And I'm up here not to diminish anyone's concerns about the gate and security and that. I think it's nice that everybody wants the security gate. We have one, and it works very well. I think the fact is that the board should consider is it was done with no permit, and it wasn't submitted to our architectural committee, which, in fact, we have to do when we do anything in our area, in Heritage Ranch, according to the Homeowners Association, we do have to submit things to the architectural committee. And in fact, when we're building things, we had a house along Nacimiento Lake Drive, the first house we owned out there, and anything we did, we had to submit to the planning department and get a permit. I think that is the fact here. It's not that everybody has a nice house and they want it and all that. I think that the man got his house on Mother's Day. That's wonderful. But the fact is, it was not permitted, and it does take up Heritage Ranch open space, which affects all of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Constance Stewart, followed by Brian Atwell. And that's my last request to speak for him. So if anyone wishes to turn one in, please do so. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. My name is Constance Stewart. I live at 9673 Reservoir Road in what is commonly referred as the fives and eights. I think that... as Mrs. Cantalupo stated, we've kind of lost sight of why we're here and why the petition is being discussed today. The gates were built without a permit in an area where it is not permitted. Like she said, and like we all have had to come under the CCNRs of the area, we've had to put permits in for when we put things up, and I think it's only fair that the developer be held to the same standards as all of us. We bought in our area for security reasons also. We're not asking that the gate be taken down, that your security be taken away. That hasn't been stated here at all today, so that's not something that we want. We just want to have it go the way it goes for the common person as well as for the developers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Brian Atwell, the last request to speak for.
Hi, my name is Brian Atwell, and I reside at 3035 Avenida del Sol in Atascadero. I am the sales associate for Midland Pacific Homes. And however, I'm not here representing Midland Pacific. My boss was here to do that today. As the sales agent, I am here to represent my buyers and the people who I had made representations to when they purchased at this property. And now what I had represented is... in jeopardy of being changed. So I'm here to just represent them. What I want to do is give you an example of, before I went to work for Midland Pacific selling homes, I was a customer. I purchased a home at the Lakes Development in Atascadero that Midland constructed 122 homes in this development. At this point, I am currently the person responsible for the volunteer resident responsible for maintaining the gates, which is the same exact kiosk entry structure that is at Riverview. It's manufactured by the same company. The entrance to the lakes, as an example of security for, you know, the 150 feet off the highway, the entrance gate of the lakes is about 150 feet off of the railroad tracks. And there are the 122 homes in here. There's also another 40 homes on the other side of Ferrocarril. So there's more than 150 homes that access this one road over the railroad tracks where the potential for backup is actually very dangerous. And the issue with the gate, with the backup of vehicles, it doesn't happen. I've lived in this type of system for 4 years. What happens is one car drives over the sensor in the road in front of the gate. That trips the gate to stay open. If there is a backup of cars once, it's a steady stream once the gate opens. There will never be a backup, you know, in that regard. And the gates do have the ability, you can manually program them to each day. You can program them to stay open a certain length of time, maybe in high traffic area, or you can set the sensor to stay open, as Mr. Harris said, up to 80 seconds between sensor trip, between vehicles. So this would allow for a steady stream of traffic. I have no issues with the design. I just wanted to give you the update and give you an example of another neighborhood with the same design. Thanks.
Thank you. One more request to speak form came in. Denise, is it Hope?
Roach. I'm the vice president of the Homeowners Association. I'm kind of actually finishing up a couple points on behalf of Mr. Laughlin. And then we're all talking about that the gate is 150 from the center line. That's 110 feet from the edge of the road. I personally own an SUV and a pontoon boat. The two combined will take up approximately 48 feet. So two, without the keypad, with the gates open, if two vehicles like that want to pull off the side of the road, somebody's back end is going to be on the inside of G14. We're not opposed to the gate. We just want them to meet, actually do what the commission said to do 2 months ago and move the gate back. Because we are going to inherit this problem. It's going to become our gate, the Homeowner Association's gate. The development will be gone, everybody will be long and gone, and it becomes part of our problem, part of our budget, and part of our liability. And I want to know how many cars, I mean, if you think no more than two cars are going to come in with 150 people with guests during the summer, and it's like Gordon said, that road is backed up. There's no room for even passing or anything. It's going to create a problem. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. As I said, that was the last request to speak for. Okay. I have no other request to speak forms, and I don't see anyone coming forward, so I will give the applicant the opportunity to respond for 3 minutes. 5 minutes. I forgot. This is a new one.
I'll try to keep it short. Thank you again, David Watts, on behalf of King Ventures. I think there were three or four comments that I'll try to address as best I can and as it relates to the significant comments that I was trying to keep track of. With regard to the issue of permits, I think it was mischaracterized at the Planning Commission level. Again, I tried this morning in my opening comments to point out to you that structures of less than 100 square feet, structures like fences that are generally 6 feet in height, do not require county permits. We didn't obviate or attempt to avoid a responsibility. We researched it and we determined that we were not liable to get permits, and so that process didn't occur. With regard to the comment that we didn't come to the association or to the AECC, as I testified at the Planning Commission level, we have CCNRs for the development that we adopted for the track. There are no less than four different places in those CCNRs where the developer has reserved the right to construct improvements such as what we're talking about without going through architectural review or going through any kind of HROA approval process. In fact, the AEC's responsibilities within Track 1910 are strictly limited to the areas within residential lots for reviewing home construction. And that's what our CCNRs say, and that's what I said in January. With regard to the question of liability, I think it's been talked about quite a bit. The only comments that I would add to what I've suggested so far today is this. We took an extensive amount of time to talk with CDF. We visited with them on site. They walked the property. Both Clint Bullard and Rob Lewin were on site and both felt that the installation of the gate was safe. It was far enough back to provide adequate distance for stacking. And the circumstances relative to the turnaround and the gates themselves for getting in and out passed muster with respect to safety. We think it's extremely safe. In fact, it's more safe than anything else that's been built out there recently or in the distant past. With regard to the whole issue of open space, it really isn't part of today's discussion. I'll be glad to talk to anybody that's interested in it. We're not stealing anything. There's an open space inventory that was created by the county, not by us. It's that issue that these people have questions over. We, as you may know, have a general plan amendment process that we've initiated that will fully discuss that issue at some point in the hopeful near future. And the whole question of how much open space and who gets credit for what open space will be plainly on the table for all to discuss. We're not here taking anybody's open space, nor have we ever suggested we would. I can say that without any reservation. Let's see. The word abomination was used. I think people are entitled to respectful differences of opinion. Would this gate be built by the next person or the next person? Perhaps not. With respect to what we felt was appropriate for the development and appropriate for the people that were coming into the project and consistent with what we had hoped was a long-range vision of tying architectural themes together with the commercial development next to the school that'll be across the street, we felt that this was an appropriate way to blend compatible architectures and to create an identity. With regard to the issues of who spoke to who, I don't want to get too far into this, but I do think it bears saying that at the January hearing, it was a material misrepresentation was made that people, most if not all people within Heritage, within Riverview at 1910, had been consulted and uniformly rejected this design. I hope the petitions, the people that have taken the time to come out today, and the discussions that we presented to you show you that the people like what's there and they're trying to see it finished in an appropriate way. So again, if I can, I'd like to direct you back to the suggestions we made earlier, and hopefully in your deliberations I'll be glad to respond to any suggestions and comments you might have. But we think removal of the main kiosk, finishing the landscaping, and toning down the colors to try to recede into the background are reasonable things that can be done quickly and bring this matter to conclusion. So we hope for your favorable consideration today. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I have two questions. Mr. Ovid.
Yeah, first question relating to the CCNR. This track was actually built with a separate set of CCNRs.
Yes.
The intent of it being, and I'll use the term, annexed to the HROA. Has that acceptance taken place yet? The track been accepted by HROA?
There are three different issues that I need to respond to. The first is that we adopt...
I know it's complicated. It's
complicated, but let me try to do what I can to make it simple. When we developed the CCNRs, we adopted by reference a set of CCNRs that had been created back in 1972 for the first track, which was common practice for most of the subdivisions at Heritage. We have a standalone set of CCNRs that are specific to track 1910, period. Those CCNRs provide, as I suggested earlier, our ability to use the common open space areas that are granted to the association for the development and completion of the tract. With respect to whether they've been accepted by the association, the deeds have been recorded with the subdivision of the property, creating the transfer of both the streets and the open space areas to HROA. To date, they have sent us a letter refusing to accept those because of their concerns over inconsistencies between our completion of the improvements and the county's requirements for the project. But for all intents and purposes, my title company tells me that the property is vested with HROA at this point, and we will still have to work through disagreements over roads and other issues that they might find to be unacceptable. Did that answer your question?
Okay. Okay, thank you. Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. were these entry gates part of the original subdivision design? Were they known to be part of that project?
No, they were not. When the subdivision was created, I think in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, there was no entry feature created.
Was the intent at that time that there would not be an entry feature?
I would be hard-pressed to tell you what the expectation was back in the late 80s, early 90s. I wasn't familiar with the project.
Okay. Mr. Watson, you mentioned that there was a site visit by representatives of the California Department of Forestry.
Yes, sir.
Regarding safety and turnaround and that sort of thing. Did you consult at all with the Highway Patrol relative to distance and setback from the highway?
No, we did not.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. With that, I will close it to the public and bring it back to the board for discussion and or a motion. Well, I have a, if nobody else, oh, there goes a light. Okay, there's two lights. But I have a question at the very end, so okay. Mr. Lenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for staff, and I guess Martha specifically. Today we've seen three different renditions, two of the gate, how it's been changed in the drawing here. I didn't see the landscaping proposal put up for the public review that was given to me in a handout. And I would appreciate your comments and thoughts regarding some of the issues as far as being resolved, as far as a compromise, how this softens the view, and would like your input.
Well, certainly the landscaping would soften the appearance of the gate structure. What it appears from this landscaping plan, though, is that the trees are behind the solid wall. I don't know how much room there is in front of the wall to install the landscaping. So if maybe that was changed to an open style fence, the landscaping would actually be visible behind it. But right now, from looking at the schematic, you're going to see trees behind the solid wall and not in front of it.
But I also see landscaping in front.
Yeah, there's C and Opus and stuff in front.
So the bushes in front of it would soften it, and then the trees in back would be visible above the wall.
Okay, Mr. Ovitt.
Yeah, I think we got to do some, I don't know, history on this thing or something, because this has been a bone of contention ever since the original developer went into bankruptcy. And it's understand that all these tracks that we're looking at today were part of the original subdivision done back when. And
I have a question.
Yeah.
What does the history have to do with the fact that it was built inside the 500-foot setback?
The question came up about, was there a design in the original track? And this is originally a gated community total. And it has been convoluted about whether this open space and the setback. Now, the setback was done in 1986. And many of the fences and the gates that you're looking at were done since 1986. And, in fact, if you look on page 49, there's one being built now. And all of them are within inside that 500-foot setback. There is some I don't know how to correctly say this, but one is considered open space and the other set 500-foot setback. And in some cases, they're not the same. The open space and the setback can be two different things. The issue I have here is that if we I think take on this gate and say it's wrong, then we're going to have to go back and look at all the others. And I don't think we need to do that. I don't think that there's any fences out there that are obtrusive, other than the old original barbed wire fences still along the road. It's never been taken down. And that's in front of a lot of the other fences that are there. I do agree that I mean, I saw this thing before it first went to the Planning Commission, and my first comment was take the guardhouse out, because I don't think that's necessary. This is a little bit different type of area than the rest of Heritage Ranch, because you've got 2,100 residents over there when it's all finished, and you only have 150 over here. So a gate will adequately service, I think, here the security issue, not a guardhouse. The guardhouse not necessary. And I've seen these gates in various different ways, and they do work. I disagree with it. Another thing that we need to look at is, and I'll just say just up the road because I don't know what kind of a distance, but probably less than a quarter of a mile or less than a half a mile, we have a school that's being built currently right now. And in order to build that school, and from my understanding we had a concurrence with the Homeowners Association, we had to go into that 500-foot setback area and build fencing for the schoolyard in order that they could build the building and meet the standards for the school. And so we have encroached again in this 500-foot area for the school. In that same area of that school, as was mentioned, you are going to have another entrance, and you are also going to have a commercial area which will be outside that entrance. And so there's a lot of activity that's happening in this area. I don't have a problem with the gate being where it's at because it is below. It does tend to, if you look at it, it doesn't silhouette, it doesn't come out and bite you. But I do think that there is some things that need to be done. I think that landscaping is important. And I think that if the color will tone it down, that's fine. But there's people that are already there using that gate now.
Any other motions?
No, not yet.
She wanted to make the last comment, so...
Well, first I want to know, is there anything that our staff would like to respond to at this point?
I think I would just add, Mr. Watson was talking about whether a building permit would be needed, and as I understand it from our building department, for things over 6 foot, 6 inches, a building permit is required, which some of the pilasters and the gate structure are. So, and I know that he's done research into a building permit, but he would need to have determination from actually our building department whether a permit was needed.
Okay, thank you. Well, actually, I like the wrought iron part of that gate. I think it's really nice, very attractive. However, I also believe it's in the wrong place. And I found the comment really interesting that once this development is completed and all, you know, everything is concluded, that then the gate becomes a property, a gate in the wrong place that's illegal becomes a property of somebody else. And I thought, hey, I wish I could do that. And relative to what Mr. Ovitz said about the other gates in the general vicinity, it reminded me of our former deputy planning director, who always used to say, we reserve the right to be wiser today than we were yesterday. And in discussions with staff yesterday, my comment was, if we do vote to uphold the Planning Commission decision, that we are going to have to be really careful of other gates out in that area. That this one, because if we approve this one, it will establish a precedent, and that we're going to have a really difficult time out there. So obviously, I will vote to uphold the Planning Commission's decision and the Planning Director and everybody else's decision. And I understand this was a unanimous vote at the Planning Commission. So with that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm going to move this forward, and basically I think what we're looking at is it's a quasi-variance in a sense that we're allowing this to go in within that 150 setback, because also that same Planning Commission was willing to look at a gate structure that was in that 500-foot setback, and I think they realized the fact, and at least raised with my Planning Commissioner, that these other gates were in existence, and you can't ignore that. So what
it's
my
as
motion...
Close, it would be as close to the 500... The Planning Commission decision was as close to that 500 feet as absolutely possible.
And what I would like to do is make a motion that we partially uphold the appeal, that one, that the guardhouse be removed, the two, that landscaping and color be completed, and that three, if a building permit is required, it be applied for.
Repeat that, please.
Yeah, the motion is to partially uphold the appeal. Okay. And that the conditions of that would be that, one, a building permit will have to be applied for, that the guardhouse will go, and that the landscaping and color would be taken into consideration, and if a building permit is applied for, it must be part of that.
And the gate will not be moved?
No. That's what the partial upholding is.
I'll second that.
I have a question. Does this need to be a tentative motion to develop new conditions or findings or amend the language of the resolution?
It probably would be advisable to do that.
So if this needs to be tentative, then do you have a date you want to bring this back?
Oh, we could probably be ready at...
Come this back this afternoon?
Yes.
Okay. Continue till 2 o'clock then.
May we have a roll call? I forgot I was chair. May we have a roll call, please? I'm waiting.
Mr. Ovitz?
Aye.
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Astrosian?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
No. With that, we will go on to item D1, please.
I'm sorry. Item D1 is presentation and discussion of the county's budget condition for fiscal year 2005-2006.
Would the people leaving the room please be quiet, because we're continuing our hearing?
Be more. Jim's headed in, Madam Chair. He's ready to be making the presentation.
There comes a technical assistant. That's what you're waiting for.
Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Grant, County Administrative Office. Today, this morning, we want to give you a brief overview of the condition of the budget for the next year as we work towards crafting a budget for your board's consideration. that you will hear in June. And so we wanted to do a brief overview for you, show you where we are, what we're thinking about, and maybe the direction we're headed, get any questions you may have, and then forge ahead from there. Nikki, next slide, please. First, the current year situation, which you're, most of you are aware of. We balanced the budget by doing a number of things. This current year was pretty rough. We reduced service levels in some areas. We reduced staff by 75 positions, basically across the board, hitting just about every area that we serve. And then in order to actually balance the budget, we used one-time reserves of $3 million to make that happen. That was something that we hadn't done really ever in my experience of reaching in and using the reserves to balance the budget. But because of the state takeaways, we had to do that to preserve the service levels that we did, even though we did cut some service levels. Next, Nikki. This is our balance sheet, basically, from here of how we did balance the budget for this current year. We have funds coming in on the left side and funds going out on the right side. The fund balance came in about $10 million. That's the money that's left over after the previous year is over, and anything that we have left over carries into the next year. That's called fund balance. And then we have discretionary revenue. That's revenue primarily property tax that comes in, sales tax, property tax, transient occupancy tax, known as bed tax, comes in and goes to a budget unit we call non-departmental revenue. That's the discretionary money that your board can use to fund things that aren't funded by themselves. Next, we have department revenue. Each department, sometimes they have fees, they have grants, they have other funding sources that they bring that revenue in to their departments to offset their cost of doing business. So we add all of that up with the $3 million in reserves, and we have a budget of $3 million and $1. That's general fund, by the way, not all funds. So going out, it's pretty simple. We have cost of doing business, our salaries and benefits and services that we provide, and then buying any type of equipment that we need. We add on to that contingency funds, which is basically a savings, in a sense, a savings fund for the year that we use to help us get through any type of emergency situations, anything that comes up in mid-year that your board may want to add to the budget. And primarily what we use these for are for looking and funding prevailing wage increases that come through towards the third quarter of each year. So in this particular case, originally we had lowered contingencies from 5%, which is your board policy, to 4%. We were able to, but at the end of the year, because of a good fund balance, we were able to nudge those contingencies up about to 5%, about 4.8%. So we're in pretty good shape for the year. We also were able to provide a little bit of new reserves, $500,000 in new reserves, and we put that in for fire equipment replacement, fire truck replacement, which we have to do on a yearly basis. So we balance the budget, and there you see that's how it worked. Next. In terms of county services, just for your boards, and these are a little bit small, I apologize for that, but this is the way the services go or provided in the county. Primarily, about 50% of our services go to health and human services. And you can see that the costs are somewhere in the neighborhood of about $140 million, and the revenue itself pretty much covers that. And that's the revenue we get from state and federal funds. So most of the health and human services areas are funded through state and federal funds, although there are times, as we've been through the year, that they pull back those funds, and then we're left on, the counties are left providing those services. And then it goes down from there. Public protection is the next where we spend our money in the next area. And then from there, land-based, which is just your planning, your public works, or your ag department. And then from there, it gets into smaller increments of funding for each of the areas that we have, finance, community services, those types of things. So, again, just sort of a picture of where the money goes. So let's move into the next year. What are we looking at for the next year? First, we start and we take a look at what does the state provide? What is the state budget going to do for us or to us, depending on the situation? And The state still this year is really facing about a $9 billion shortfall, although the governor's budget, according to the Legislative Analyst Office at the state level, the governor's budget eliminates the shortfall through program reductions that he has proposed. And remember, it just is a proposal. Nothing is concrete yet and won't be for quite some time. So the reductions that the governor is looking at are mainly in the kindergarten through 12 education, cutting some of the social services grants to participants, and then employee compensation, state employee compensation, excuse me, for the most part. But what affects us is Prop 42 payments. That's transportation funds to counties, and that's about $1.3 million lost to us this year, this next year. There's also deficit financing bonds that are needed to help get, basically borrow into that they have on hand to help them get through the year. There is a proposal out there to for the state to pull back in their support of the in-home supportive services wage participation, which I can talk about a little bit more in a minute. And then the biggie is the second year takeaway of the $1.3 billion in local property taxes. That's where they're shifting property taxes from counties, cities, and special districts to the state to help balance the budget. So that's how the governor proposes to do that. What that means to us, at least preliminarily, is that the property tax shift is about $2.3 million for next year. Now, originally, it was around $5 million, but after the budget, a state budget was approved earlier this year, that formula changed, and so we actually are seeing a bit of a savings, quite a bit of a savings almost, of the property tax shift. Still, it's $2.3 million that we have already included in our projections that we will lose in that shift. The roads budget will lose about $1.3 million in transportation funds. We have mandate reimbursement funds that we get from the state. That is that the counties provide certain services that the state mandates that we have to provide, typically in the health and social services areas. Well, they are pulling back on the reimbursements of those mandates. So if a county wants to continue to fund those services, then that county is on the hook to provide the funds to do that. In other words, a hit to the general fund to keep those services intact. We're going to lose around $1 million, although there's still some discussion at the state level of how all that's going to work. But that's our best guess at the moment. Criminal justice, there's a $500,000 rural crime grant that is supposed to go away. It was supposed to go away this year, but it came back, so it goes back and forth. We're not counting on it next year, though. We think it's going to be gone. And then some property tax administration funds that the state provides to help us in the assessor's office maintain property tax administration and going out and assessing property. We're going to lose around $75,000 to $80,000 in that neighborhood. So we're looking at around $5 million in cost. Now, let me get back to in-home supportive services. If the state reduces their participation in that, the bottom line in that is that our county, we have a contract with the employee union that says that if the state pulls back, we will state the county can also pull back on the amount of money. We're not on the hook to provide the balance of that. If we were to provide that balance, though, after the state pulled back, it would cost us somewhere in the neighborhood of around $2 million if we were going to do that. But that decision has not been made, and that's not the way the contract reads right now. So that could be a discussion point later on as we move through the next few months as we craft a budget. I just want to let your board know that that's out there, that is a concern, and something we may have to deal with. So now we'll take a look at a little bit. That's sort of what the state's going to affects on the county budget. We're going to look at what we have locally. So, Nikki, if you'll go to the next one, please. We have some major budget increases that we have to deal with. And it's nothing new. We have to deal with it most every year. But, in fact, the workers' comp is still going up. And we are increasing the workers' compensation fund, basically $2.3 million, to deal with the ongoing workers' compensation issues. We hope, and the state hopes, that someday that those numbers will come down. But at this point in time, that's not happening. And so we have to fund adequately our role in the workers' compensation program. Additionally, liability insurance has gone up almost, $800,000 plus, and we have to deal with that as well to keep current. And then salaries and benefits, those are always fairly large. We have about a $7 million increase in salaries and benefits going into the next year. That includes just an estimate at this point of $2.5 million for the Deputy Sheriff's Association. We don't know how that will end up, but I've included that in the budget to make sure that it is part of our budget discussions. So then let's take a look at the revenue, particularly discretionary revenue, because that's where really the rubber hits the road. And how much do we have discretionarily to spend on programs that we think are important? And so if we move to the next slide, we can look at discretionary revenue. It actually looks good for next year. Overall, it's about a $13 million increase, which is healthy for our county. Primarily, it's in the property tax revenue area. We've had about a 9% increase in property tax from year to year, which generates quite a bit of revenue. We've also had the savings from that property tax shift I've mentioned. Originally thought it was $5 million. It's really about $2.3 million. So we've gained a substantial amount of revenue in the property tax area. The other big funding sources that we have is vehicle license fees. That will be up a few million dollars. Sales tax, which is fairly even, a little bit up. Transient occupancy tax, again, the bed tax, which remains about even. Property transfer tax, a little bit of an increase there. And then franchise fees, also a bit of an increase. But overall, about a $13 million increase. What that does is, even if we add all of that up and we throw that into the budget, if we look at what we would call a status quo budget, or the state would call a current law budget, that means if we were going to do the same thing next year that we're doing this year, no service increases, not talking about service increases at all, maintaining the same staffing, then when we look at our balance sheet here, we're about $2 million out of balance right now. Okay, so that's our challenge right now, is how do we fund a status quo budget, again, not increasing any service levels. There could be decreases in service levels, as a matter of fact. How do we get back in balance? If we go a little step further and go to what we would call our traditional budget, that means the departments ask for what they believe they need, then looking at that and adding that up, the department's needs really outpace what we have by about $7 million. So we're about $7 million out of balance at that point. So if the sheriff is asking for additional patrol deputies, if the roads are asking for additional roads money, whatever is out there, and the departments are on their, they ask, and we just put it in at this point in the traditional budget, the $7 million, we'd be $7 million out of balance. So that's our challenge there. Nikki, next one, please. So what do we do? Well, what we're doing right now is we're trying to apply a balanced approach to reducing budgets with the intent to minimize service cuts to the public. So we're headed towards, as much as we can, the status quo budget so that we think we can keep what we have intact at this point in time. Again, don't know exactly how that's going to work out, because on the state-mandated side, the health and human services side, if the state cuts back a dollar, we would normally expect those programs to cut back a dollar as well. The county wouldn't overmatch that. We would just say you need to cut back because the state is saying that they're not going to provide us the money to provide the service. We're also looking at utilizing performance measures to guide the recommendations. We're looking now, we're pushing more and more into the performance measure area. What are those departments doing in their performance measures, and how they're providing service to the public? If they're doing very well, then we're going to look at that and say, maybe that takes, we need to look at that. Maybe we need to enhance that service even more to provide, if they're performing well. On the other hand, if they're not, we should maybe look at the programs that aren't performing well and decide how we're going to deal with those. And then the third area is, again, like we did this year, use reserves to prevent drastic service level cuts. Drastic. And we had planned on doing that this next year if we needed to. So, again, we're looking at that. Nikki, if you go back, can you go back right there? The other things that we're looking at right now, too, and I want to tell the board this is early, so really don't take these numbers to heart, but the fund balance we've estimated at this point at $13 million. It may be bigger than that, and if it is, that's great. That will help us fund more programs into the next year. We also, if you look at contingencies on the going outside there, it's at $15 million. That's 5% of what the current costs are. We could, as we did in this current year, recommend that we go to maybe 4%. It saves a few million dollars to do that. So there are some options for us without cutting programs. We can look at easing reserves. We hope the fund balance comes in a little higher than we anticipate. And we could reduce contingencies. So there are ways we can come to a balanced budget that we can present to your board. Nikki? So if we looked at reserves, just so the board knows, in reserves for the general fund, we have general reserves of $8 million, exactly. And we have tax reduction reserves of $12 million. On the tax reduction reserve side, we've put aside in the prior years, when the years were pretty good, we put aside money in this fund to help. For these types of things that come up, those budgets, the budget years that are tight. So we have $20 million in reserves that we could tap if we want to. We would not suggest doing that and using all of those funds in one year. We think that the way we portrayed it this in the current year, where we use a few million dollars of reserves, again, to help reduce drastic service level cuts are the way to do it. But we need to have a balanced budget. We can't have a deficit budget. We have to have a balance, and this could help. So what are our next steps? Well, the first thing is we monitor the state budget discussions. They're just now getting underway. The governor has a proposal out. The legislature is looking at that. There'll be endless hours of discussion in terms of what will happen and what won't happen. We won't know until at least May, when the governor's revised budget comes out, and quite possibly June or July, and sometimes August, before we actually know what happens. But we're going to follow that and make mid-course corrections along the way. We also are working with departments to craft a proposed budget, looking at what they're providing us, looking at service levels, looking at performance measures, and coming up with our recommendations. We will present a proposed budget to your board in May, May 25th to be exact, and then we'll have budget hearings starting on June 20th. And that concludes my presentations, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Yes, Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grant, would you describe what the tax reduction revenue or reserve fund is?
Right. The tax reduction reserve fund was put together, again, over the last number of years when we had enough funds to put into reserves. The board felt it would be prudent to set up a tax reduction reserve and to put a few million in it here or there over the years, and now it's built up to about $12 million, in anticipation that we would have someday the state coming down and shifting funds from property tax funds from the counties to the state. And if we ran into those difficulties, we would be able to use those reserves to help really give us a soft landing rather than going and drastically cutting service levels. Mm-hmm. You're welcome. No, this is a general reserve that we can use in any way that we want.
Okay, Mr. Seabach.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. Jerry Seabach, Auditor Controller. I just wanted to jump in, and it's correct that the general reserve is supposed to be for emergencies like natural disasters, floods, earthquakes, and that kind of thing. But at budget time, it can be used for other things if you wish. During the year, it's supposed to be reserved for only disasters, declared emergencies. But on the tax reduction reserve that Supervisor Patterson asked about, another purpose for that, and I recommended that fund be established some years ago, was we had just taken a big whack from PG&E and the devaluation of the power plant and the restructuring of the electrical energy system in California. So this was to kind of build an insurance fund in case Diablo Canyon either shut down or the tax stream of revenue from the utility role, mainly Diablo, was changed or interrupted in a big way. We're still getting, I think, about $15 million a year just from PG&E. So that's still a worry for us at any time. We, you know, $12 million would get us through 1 year if we lost the whole thing. So I agree with Mr. Grant absolutely that it's a source to be used judiciously. It is available when to bridge, have a soft landing kind of a thing. But the big worry in my mind was an interruption in the property tax stream or another major reduction like we took when the devaluation happened or the deregulation happened.
Okay, thank you. I have no other lights, so I will open it to the public. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to make a statement? Seeing no one stand up, I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. This is just an acceptance of receive and file, so to speak. So all in favor? Well, is there a motion?
Second.
So all in favor? Yes. The voice vote. Are we in favor of doing this?
Aye.
Yes, thank you. Okay. With that, we have now arrived at 12 o'clock. We have two more items to hear this morning. Is it the pleasure of this board to move those two items over to this afternoon?
Yes. Yes.
Do I hear any more yeses from the left? Yes. Okay, that's a majority, so Harry can just sit there quietly. So with that, we will. Yeah, we will go into closed session. I have one request to speak for him, Eric.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I'm speaking on item number two, Santa Margarita Area Residents Together versus the County of San Luis Obispo. This has to do with an action taken on September 14th, which amounts to a general plan amendment and did not go through that process. When you eliminate a criterion, and in this case it's figure 2.2 of the ag and open space element, when you actually eliminate something, you're not implementing, you are amending. This did not go through the general plan amendment process. No one in the public would have had any reason to anticipate that in one hearing, in one action on September 14th, the general plan could be amended in this way. And I would just ask you to remember this issue of process. The substance of it is something that hopefully could be talked about in the proper way, whatever decision you want to make or whatever direction you want to go. But from the standpoint of process, the process didn't happen. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Eric. With that, we will go into closed session and return down here at 2 p.m. Okay, the Board of Supervisors is back in session. May we have a report out of closed session, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Board met in closed session this morning on the items listed on the agenda. The Board took no final action on any particular item, therefore no public report is required, and that's the public report. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have one item left from this morning to conclude.